Florida lawmakers are taking the issue of human trafficking head-on. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The issue took national headlines earlier this year when New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft was charged with soliciting a prostitute at a massage parlor in Jupiter. We're going to talk with State Senator Lauren Book. She'll also explain actions that she's taken now in response to Alabama's new abortion law. Also, this weekend is the fourth annual Real Minds Film Festival. It's an event that tries to bring attention to mental health issues through film. We spoke with director Roberto Sanchez, a Cuban-American raised in Miami, about his new film, The Terms of Us, a movie that mirrors his relationship with his estranged mother. And can a manicurist be considered an artist? Can painted nails represent more than just a fashion statement, maybe a social statement? We'll talk to the artist behind the Porn Nail Salon. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Human trafficking remains a big problem in Florida. There have been cases of immigrants from China and Latin America coming to the U.S. seeking legitimate work, but then they find themselves entrapped in a cycle of sex and labor that's nearly impossible to break out of. Now, the issue was launched into the national spotlight this past February with the arrest of New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft at a massage parlor in Jupiter. Lawmakers this session pushed new legislation that would tackle the human trafficking crisis through a number of different avenues. Democratic State Senator Lauren Book was behind the legislation that awaits the governor's signature. She's also been an outspoken voice on women's reproductive rights. Yesterday, she came out with a statement and an interesting proposal in response to the restrictive Alabama abortion law that was just signed by their governor. She joins us now on Sundial. Senator Book, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with the law in Alabama. This is the big news right now. From your understanding, under what circumstances would it be legal for a woman to have an abortion in Alabama?
Right now, as it stands, as the bill was signed yesterday, it would be health of the woman. And so if it were an ectopic pregnancy, an abortion may be performed. But other than that, there is no exemption for rape, for incest. Nothing else is contemplated. And what's really, truly terrifying is that these providers will be sentenced under the felony guidelines in the bill to up to 99 years for performing an abortion, for providing life-saving medical care to women in the state of Alabama. It is unconscionable that this is where we are in our world. And more terrifying than any of that is that women make up to 51% of the population of Alabama, but there were only four women in that Senate chamber representing them. And it is truly, truly horrifying.
There was legislation that came up in Tallahassee in this session. It would require minors to receive parental consent in Florida prior to having the procedure. That ultimately failed. What were the conversations surrounding that bill in the legislature?
Well, that was actually heard in one of my committees in health policy, and it would have required both parents providing consent, again, with no exemption for rape or incest. It was highly, highly controversial. And we actually had abortion providers coming in talking about the judicial waiver process, because if a young woman or a woman could not get the parental waiver, there is a judicial bypass that they can access. And so my office and I spent hours calling through to different clerk of courts throughout the state. And many of them did not know what we were asking about. And yet we want these young women to navigate this process, all while trying to navigate some really tough decisions that they have to make. And it was, you know, it did not get its second hearing. It did pass in the House, however. And that is where we are in our world. We are waging war against women. And, you know, I find it to be interesting. I think about Kamala Harris asking a question of now Justice Kavanaugh about laws that the government has kind of power to regulate men's bodies. And there isn't any. And yet we continue to chip away at women's reproductive health care, their reproductive rights. And, you know, I can't think of a more cruel and unusual punishment than to require a woman to carry a baby to term if she does not want to after a sexual assault or after a case of incest. It is just a terrifying place that we are living in.
And speaking of Kamala Harris, she, of course, from California, one of the candidates running for president, you want to craft legislation for next year's session that would require equal representation when it comes to new laws restricting access to abortion. Can you give us a preview of what that would look like?
Absolutely. You know, American democracy is built on the value of representation, and the joint resolution really stems from that core value to say no vote about women without women. It spans across all the political spectrums, but it would require that a measure to be put on the ballot to empower Floridians to vote, that if we're going to look at women's reproductive health care and their rights, that 50% of those that are making those laws and making those decisions be women. If abortion were to be taken away from women, women should be sitting at the table helping to make those decisions.
So that all comes down to who's being voted into office. If you don't have enough women in office, then it can never be it can never be brought up then.
Correct. Correct. That is correct.
Have you heard anybody responded to this? Anybody reached out to you? The lawmakers talked to you about this?
I've talked to some of my colleagues and in the last 24 to 48 hours who truly are outraged and horrified at the things that are happening in Alabama, in Georgia with the heartbeat ban. You know, we are under attack, and people may think that this is far afield. I think that taking away a woman's fundamental right to access to healthcare is far afield and is deplorable and the definition of unconscionable. Again, requiring a woman who has been sexually assaulted to carry a baby to term is cruel and unusual punishment, in my opinion. And if women need to be sitting at the table when decisions are being made about their rights and their ability to navigate life.
And pundits have said that what we've seen in Georgia and Alabama is basically a push to bring this up to the Supreme Court and challenge Roe v. Wade. So, you know, depending on what the U.S. Supreme Court does next, do you think that plays a role in you pushing forward this legislation next year, or are you still pushing it anyway?
I'm still pushing it regardless. Again, I believe that we have to be represented. It's a core democratic principle and value. And if we are going to be making decisions about women's reproductive health care, women's reproductive rights, then women need to be at the table. And again, there are no laws on the books that regulate men's bodies or the things and healthcare options that they have. Why are women why are roadblocks being put in front of women every single day? And I think about, you know, the totality of this issue and where we've come from. You know, in the 50s and the 60s, when abortion, started to become, you know, this issue that it is today. You know, women had to go before a tribunal, basically, of doctors, white men, and they had to beg for a procedure that dealt with their body. And 9 times out of 10, those women were told, yes, we'll give you an abortion, but you also have to be sterilized. And then there was a time in our history, not too long ago, in the 60s, where women had to go to back alleys and use hangers to terminate pregnancies. I know that people think this is hyperbolic, that this is not going to occur. This is a real reality for my daughter, who is 2 years old, that we are putting these roadblocks in place now and today. I think about her choices, her decisions, and we must be paying attention. This is not an Alabama issue. This is not a Georgia issue. This is a women's human rights issue.
I'm talking with Democratic State Senator Lauren Book, representing Florida's 32nd district. We have been talking about her response to the recent passing of the restrictive abortion bill in Alabama. I want to switch things up a little bit because I wanted to talk to you about another bill that is awaiting Governor Ron DeSantis's signature, this dealing with the issue of human trafficking, something you pushed very hard for in this session. This is a problem that you've been working on for a number of years. Do you believe that the bill was propelled, though, by the media coverage surrounding the arrest of New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft back in Palm Beach County? Did that play a role in helping get this forward?
You know, I think that that good legislation takes time. I think that we had a House and Senate that were committed to looking at this issue and looking at it in a comprehensive manner. This bill that passed is a comprehensive approach to human trafficking and combating human trafficking. It has many different components to it that I'm really proud of, but this is not a one-stop that will fix and solve human trafficking. I think that all of those things play a part, but I think also, too, the fact that we have major large-scale events like the Super Bowl, like the national championship coming to our state, we definitely have a lot of work to do.
And you talk about there are a number of facets in this legislation. Let's try to hit a couple of these. One of them being proposed is creating a list for soliciting for prostitution public database. Basically, this, I guess, is this a list basically of John Does and pimps? I mean, what would this entail?
So one of the things that we tried to tackle after visiting different places throughout the state and looking at the issue of human trafficking is the issue of supply and demand. We know that there is one simple rule. There's no demand. There's no supply. Humans buying humans for the purpose of sex is a heinous act that occurs with repeat offenders. And a study by the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention found that 70% of sex buyers want to stop. And then we have a coupling 2011 study that was done at Boston University that asked sex buyers what would get them to stop purchasing sex. And it was some form of public registry. Now, that's not what is contained within this bill. This is a database of pimps and johns, those that purchase sex and those that that pimp individuals in this universe. This is already public information that is out there in one place.
Okay, no, because I was going to say, was this for just law enforcement or anybody could see that database? Anybody has access to it?
Anyone has access to it. And I think that one of the things that really kind of puts this into perspective, that human trafficking is one of the largest growing criminal enterprises in the world. In fact, it's actually it's second to the drug trafficking trade, and it's a $32 billion industry, and it's growing every single day. It's set to outpace drug trafficking. And there are 40 million victims of human trafficking in the U.S. today. And worst of all of that, half of those victims are under the age of 18. And we do need to take bold steps to ensure that we're stopping this and that the state of Florida is closed for business in sex trafficking. And I think that that is part of what this bill goes to do.
You know, there's a fundamentally deeper question on this issue. And, you know, on a personal note, is something that I remember covering as before my job before this, I was in Las Vegas. And so, of course, I want to bring up, this issue that exists in Nevada where sex work in some parts of Nevada is legal and it has a lot of protections for the female workers, from health care protections to, of course, you know, personal safety protections. Do you ever think that there will be a time when when you talk about prostitution, that it would ever even be considered as a thing to be made legal in the state of Florida to give the workers protections?
I mean, We are a state that is hugely diverse, right? And I think that I don't know that we are going to get to that time, but if I had a crystal ball, I would also know how to solve a lot of the issues that exist in our state and in our world. But I think that I heard from a lot of the consensual sex workers in that industry, and we worked really hard to try to sit at the table to come up with a policy and a measure that would include some of the things that they brought, because it is important that we make sure that everyone is represented. And who better to know what's going on in that world and in that industry than consensual sex workers, because they do exist. And it is a piece of the puzzle. And so we sat down with a lot of those folks, some of which were not very keen on the database. But we do believe that this is important. And I would say, in terms of, some of the regulating that industry and legalizing or decriminalizing prostitution,
And
it does create a black market for that.
with those workers, what are their concerns about the database? What have they said about the database?
I think at the time when the bill was first introduced, it was a registry. And they did not want to, I believe, as one consensual sex worker said, did not want to put people that she worked with and for in a place where they would not continue to utilize her services. And I think that that is, a very valid point for her and for her livelihood. However, that is not what this bill contains. I think that, again, when we look at the numbers and we talk about human trafficking and what that means in our state, that Florida is third in the country for human trafficking, we need to take bold steps to ensure that we're making Florida a non-slave state. And so one of the things that we did to when really working with the industry of consensual sex workers was making this database. It does have a sunset after 3 years, and an OPAGA study after 2 years. We're not looking to go after individuals just for the sake of going after individuals and embarrassing people into not purchasing sex. We have a duty and an obligation to create laws that work to move the needle and make a difference. Again, that's what this, I believe, component does. We have studies that show purchasing of sex occurs. However, 89% of those purchasers of sex say if there was some form of a public registry, they would not engage in those behaviors. The supply and
Right.
demand would dictate if people aren't buying it, we're not going to utilize
I
them.
wanted to in the before we finish up here, is come back to another aspect of the law, which is training that would be required for law enforcement, hotel workers, and massage parlor workers in identifying signs of human trafficking. Real quickly, how would that training work? Who's administering it?
So, absolutely, hotels, law enforcement, massage parlors, it would be under the department, DBPR. If those trainings aren't being done in hotels, a hotel will be fined $2,000 a day.
I'm sorry, you
And
said DBPR?
the Department of Regulation for the
Thank you.
state of Florida. And if those trainings aren't being done, hotels could be fined up to $2,000 a day. And those fines will be given to the direct support organization that's created under this bill, under the Attorney General's auspices, to provide really life-changing support and services for survivors of trafficking. There's a huge dearth of services for survivors of trafficking. We know that there are about 20 beds for therapy from Key West to West Palm Beach. We simply don't have enough to deal with some of the really intensive needs that these survivors have.
Are you confident that Governor DeSantis is going to sign the bill, or at least he won't veto it?
I am hopeful that the governor, along with, I believe that the governor has a bold sense for protecting Florida's most vulnerable. And again, Florida will not be a slave state. I believe that, and I am hopeful that the governor signs this bill. I know that this is something that we worked on with the attorney general. Again, a lot of the components of this bill would be under her auspices. And I believe that Florida should be closed for business for human traffickers, and making sure that we continue to take bold steps to end what is occurring here. And we have some incredible, incredible opportunities in our state with, like we said, the Super Bowl, the national championships that are coming here, NASCAR, some of our incredible, incredible tourist attractions. One of the things that should not occur here is slavery. And we're working to make sure that that's not the case.
We've been talking with Democratic State Senator Lauren Book, representing Florida's 32nd District. Again, new legislation awaiting the governor's signature, again, addressing the issue of human trafficking in the state of Florida. You can learn more about it at our social media at WLRN Sundial. Senator Book, it's been a pleasure, always. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, still to come, a one-day film festival this weekend looks at mental health from different perspectives. We spoke with the Miami director about his movie, Terms of Us. That's coming up next on Sundial. And welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thanks again for joining us today. Well, we hear it a lot in conversations. Americans are struggling with mental health issues. Medical statistics show that 1 in 5 American adults have recently dealt with a mental health issue, and 1 in 25 have dealt with a serious mental illness. And maybe making the issue more common in our conversations is helping people to overcome the stigma and fears associated with it. This weekend is the Real Minds Film Festival, an event that also tries to tackle the issues of mental health. And we recently spoke with Roberto Sanchez, a Cuban-American who grew up in Miami, who starred and directed a short film for this festival. It's called The Terms of Us. It's the story of a man who has a chance encounter with a homeless woman struggling with mental illness. We started our conversation with Roberto explaining how he came up with the story.
I was in Miami working on a film, and a good friend of mine, his mother got ill and her health declined rapidly. She was in the hospital for a few weeks, and ultimately she passed. But it was during this time that I started to reflect on the relationship with my mom, whom at the time I had not seen in 11 years. It was due to so many things, man. You know, sometimes we grow up and we have issues with our parents, and some are deeper than others, as was mine. But, you know, I really started to wonder, I mean, why were we not talking? Was it something that we could fix, you know? At that point, we're a small family. It's just my brother, my cousin, and myself. Nobody knew where she was. All we knew that was that she was in Miami somewhere. And once I got back home to L.A., I was able to look for her Social Security number. I was the only one that had it. And with that, and a friend at Miami-Dade, we were able to locate her.
And when you found her?
Oh, man. I'll never forget, man. I was now filming in L.A. It had been now about 3 or 4 weeks since I had left Miami. I'm now in L.A., driving to work on another film. And I'm on the highway. And my friend calls me on the phone. He's like, yo, what are you doing? I said, I'm on my way to work. He says, well, can you pull over? Because I got to talk to you. And, you know, I had forgotten about that because he was the one that had the connection with Miami-Dade. So he was the middleman. But I had forgotten. And he says, no, I need you to pull over. So, man, I pull over on the highway. And I said, what's up? And he says, yo, man, we found your mom, you know. And I mean, you can only imagine, man, after 11 years, I was like, what? Immediately, I'm thinking about what to do next. I mean, I got to call my brother, my cousin. Oh, my gosh, she ain't going to believe it, this and that. And as I'm talking out loud, you know, he's trying to get my attention, but I'm just so caught up in the moment. And then finally he says, stop, you know, and I stopped, man. And he said, we found her, but she died 6 months ago. The world just stopped, man. I was on the side of the road there for what seemed like an eternity. And then, you know, I had to call my brother, of course, and then my cousin. You know, it ended up being a couple hours. I ended up, of course, you know, showing up late to work. They were ready to send me home. It took a few years to be able to put those thoughts and those feelings into words and then create the script and ultimately the film. But that's where the whole idea came from.
This is a fascinating story in that your character has an encounter with a homeless woman. And this is a homeless woman struggling with mental illness. And all of a sudden, it just makes your character think about his own family and his mother. And, you know, where did the idea for the homeless woman come from?
For me personally, it's times when I'm driving, man, and I'll see someone just sitting on the ground or sleeping on the ground, just in the middle of the street, man. And I'm taken aback by that. I think that some people can easily see that and wouldn't even think twice. But for some reason, that has always affected me, and didn't know why. But, you know, once we were able to find the whereabouts of my mom, and then we were able to retrace some of her steps, we find out that at one point or another, she was also homeless. So perhaps that's where somehow that vibe and that idea about casting the homeless woman and creating this role for her came from.
One of the struggles in, I guess, capturing the issue of mental illness in a story on film is being accurate. And I'm wondering for you as the filmmaker, what was your approach in how you try to tackle this issue of mental illness so that you get it right?
My sole purpose was to just make this story and be as truthful as I could possibly be. It will help people reevaluate relationships in their lives and see if it's fixable. Not all relationships are, but if it's something worthwhile fixing, perhaps, you know, this film will make you think twice about that. And then, of course, the mental illness aspect of it, that was just, again, being truthful to what I experienced as a child, not knowing what someone being bipolar, what that was like, not really knowing about depression, you know, and these were things that my mom went through. And it wasn't until I became an adult that I started to recognize all the signs, all those moments, all those outbursts, all those things. So again, for me, it was just about being truthful, and hopefully that would show once the film came up.
I'm talking with Roberto Sanchez, the director behind the new film, The Terms of Us. It follows the story of actor Jose Garcia in his chance encounter with a homeless woman struggling with mental illness that led him to a journey to try to find his mother. The film is screening at the Real Minds Film Festival Sunday, May 19th. Roberto, you live in L.A., but you grew up in Miami.
I sure did, man. I'm Cuban. I was born in Cuba and got to Miami when I was 3 years old. So, yeah, I was raised in Miami.
You know, being of Cuban descent, but, you know, getting here when you were so young, I'm wondering, what was it like for you growing up in Miami as a Cuban American with little memory, really, if any, of Cuba?
Even now, you know, when I think back, obviously, I can't remember of anything when I was in Cuba. So everything I know is Miami. So for me, that was a normal way of life. I was more Americanized than Cuban, really. And it wasn't until, you know, my firstborn that I really started to think about my roots and really wanting to do some research and find out, you know, about my culture, the music, the food, these things that I think sometimes we take for granted. And especially growing up here in the U.S., you can sometimes, you know, break away from your culture. Even if you don't really mean to, you just get caught up, you know, with just, you know, America. So when my first son was born, then that's really when I really wanted to get back in touch with my roots so I could share that with him.
For you, how did connecting to your roots make its way into this movie?
You know, it just, I could have easily filmed that in L.A. In fact, I did. But not even pretend that we were in Miami at one point. But I think that it was important to add a little bit of that, even in the some music that we have in there that's very salsa-ish, very very Cuban, and I thought that was important to, you know, for people that are watching it to be able to feel that culture, because you know, a lot of times I don't have to say that I'm Cuban, but when you hear me speak, or you hear the type of music that I listen to, or even the way that I dress or the way that I carry myself, sometimes that comes across. And again, I think that that's important. So I wanted to make sure that in the film I had little elements of that so that the audience could see some of that.
This was your directorial debut?
Yes, it was.
So what's it like approaching filmmaking? Because you've been doing this a long time now, but now you're doing it from not just in front of the camera, behind the camera.
It was a little difficult in that I was directing the film, but I was also one of the actors in the film. So that can be tricky, trying to direct yourself and watch the scene when you're actually in it. That was for me was the most difficult part. But, you know, for me, it was a story about passion. I don't know that I'd want to direct again. There's times when I say, well, I would like to tell this story or that story. But for right now, it's just something that I wanted to do for this particular film.
And besides that challenge, I'd also imagine, because you tackled this really difficult story. I mean, you're talking about a guy who's not talked to his mother in a long time, goes and looks for her, and then, of course, finds out that she has passed. And now he's got to deal with the emotion of that and a lot of regret. And you're doing this in a very short film. I mean, you got this is a story you could stretch out for a while.
I know that a lot of people have told me that I should do it in a feature film format. And I just don't feel that I was ready to tackle that. I felt that, you know, if I'm going to do this, and I knew the one thing I did know was that I did want to direct it because no one can really tell your story better than you can. So that was important for me. And yeah, man, tackling the issues of guilt, man, is something that I've had to deal with. And people told me, hey, look, when you do this, I think it could be cathartic for you and it'll help. But I'll be honest, man, it hasn't. It's been more difficult than I anticipated, because even during post-production, when you're editing, you're reliving the story over and over and over again, man. So it's like I'm marinated in this feeling and this reminder of guilt. So, you know, I'm just hoping that, man, you know, once it's all said and done and the film, you know, the film is done doing its festival circuit, that hopefully at that point things will start to get a little better. But that's been probably the hardest part for me.
Roberto, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you.
That was Roberto Sanchez, the director behind the new film, The Terms of Us. It follows the story of actor Jose Garcia and his encounter with a homeless woman struggling with mental illness. The film is screening as part of the 4th annual Real Minds Miami Mental Health Film Festival at the University of Miami this Sunday. It's being presented by the NAMI Miami-Dade County, and you can learn more on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, women who get their nails done don't just do it for fashion. There's stories to tell. We'll learn more about it coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Again, thank you so much for joining us today. Well, you walk into a nail salon and you experience a cacophony of sights, smells, and sounds. There's the sharp smell of the acrylic paint. Mix that with the juicy conversations. And don't forget the endless array of colored nails. Well, this weekend at the Nova Southeastern University's Art Museum in Fort Lauderdale, there will be a one-day symposium called A Sense of Pride, Visual Activist and New Identities. And one of the events there is a mobile pop-up nail salon that will be featuring a series of paintings and nail decor. It's called Poor Nail Salon, and it's celebrating queer and feminine identity. Rosemarie Romero is the installation's brainchild. She's an artist and a licensed manicurist. Rosemarie, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And by the way, I just wanted to mention, we have more details about the symposium. You can learn it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. First of all, tell us, what is the Porn Nail Salon? Help us understand.
So a Porn Nail Salon is a nail salon installation that I take into public space. And I exchange colorful, I do really colorful nails with rhinestones and designs in exchange for very juicy conversations about sex, love, and work.
Where did the idea come from?
I was doing my MFA program at UF, and I just wanted to make an artwork that encapsulated my values, the way I grew up, my love of nail art, and how to bring community together. And I also wanted it to be funny and campy and kitsch, and to talk about the South Florida nail art lifestyle.
I mean, calling it the Poor Nail Salon, you're already halfway there. I mean, I thought this was interesting. So you're an artist, but you're also a manicurist. I don't know if you could say they're both the same, but I think that's an interesting idea, this concept that you're creating art on this tiny little surface.
Absolutely.
The nail. What does that mean to you?
For me, it's almost a form of miniature painting. And it's like elevated to the status of fine art and sculpture. And it's funny because I had my MFA in art, and then after I graduated, I went straight to beauty school to learn the art of manicuring and nail art. So it was like a whole new world for me. So I had nail art teachers. I got to meet some of the nail artists that were trying to learn. There were recent immigrants from Cuba and other countries. So it was definitely a new art form to learn.
And for you, I mean, my understanding too, you kind of grew up with this.
I did. So I grew up in Miami since I was a kid with Hispanic parents. My mom, she was studying to be an esthetician, so I was always around beauty salons, and she was obsessed with manicures, hair, and facials. So we would be at the salon all the time.
By the way, it's, I have to mention it because we were talking about it before the show started. So you brought it. Look, we're going to put a picture up on Facebook in a little bit. But your nails, oh, my gosh.
Yes, they're very colorful. Neon.
Describe it real quickly. By the way, they also look very sharp, but describe the patterns and where you came up with those.
So the nails that I have on now, they're like a color marble of neon pink, purple, and blue color swirls.
So Miami. So Miami.
Very Miami.
Explain to us about this, you know, a little more about the pop-up nail salon that you're setting up and what it's going to look like. But more than that, the experience that you want people to have when they come up.
Right. So when I do my art installation, it's very flamboyant, colorful. It's draped with sequins. I decorate the walls with glittery butterflies and mirrors and a neon nail salon sign.
And you have very purple hair when you do this.
Very purple hair.
It's a wig that you wear, by the way.
Yeah, I love to dress up and wear wigs and really loud makeup.
And what is it? What's the experience you want people to have when they come and sit down with you?
I want people to feel like they can tell me stories about their life, their triumphs and their tragedies while trusting me in the conversation. And I also want them to laugh. So I always try to make my conversations very funny.
Why do you call it the porn nail salon?
So I call it porn nails specifically to reclaim the term porn from its ugly connotation and just make it signify to mean pleasure and obsession with something like nails. And it's also slang for me about overly decorated glittery nails.
This is something, not just at this, you know, symposium, but I mean, this is popped, you've popped this up in different places, right?
Absolutely. I'm very deliberate about where I pop up. My porn nails salon is an artwork, and I think about context a lot. So I do a lot of them in queer parties, drag shows, music festivals, and the sort.
Yeah. Now, you know what? I mean, look, I obviously I don't do my nails. All right. But I guess I've always grown up thinking it's just part of a fashion thing. But, you know, talking to my producer, Alejandra, she, you know, I'm learning that there's more to it. There's a statement sometimes in your nails and the way you decorate them. How so? Help me understand that.
Yes. So nail art culture in the Latinx and Black community is very important. It's a way to elevate your mood, elevate your status, and feel about yourself. It's self-expression.
Status, how so?
It's like a status of how you feel, how to assert yourself. Almost like high heels, right?
Okay.
It makes you feel really confident. And for me, that's status.
When you were, like, for example, when you did your nails, these nails, specifically this design, what are you thinking about and feeling as you're doing this?
It's like a form of therapy and empowerment for me. Yeah. It's like a self-transformation. Makes me feel like a superhero sometimes.
And then when you're set up the pop-up salon and you're having these conversations with people, where do the conversations tend to go?
They tend to go to stories about relationships. We talk about politics, queerness, and also funny things that happen in our life. So it's a very intimate, beautiful moment. And I love hearing people's stories. And I think it builds a lot of empathy for the other.
Now, I know that, understanding in the world we live in today that you're going to have, all kinds of gender identity come.
Absolutely.
But a lot of the time, salon, it'd be fair, right? It's mostly women.
Yes.
Right? Okay. I mean, I think about it in terms of like, maybe is it like the barbershop? I go to the barbershop and it's just a bunch of us guys sitting around talking to each other, telling jokes and, talking politics. And that's kind of the same thing, right?
Absolutely. The gossip of the day, the politics, women's rights, gay rights. That's the kind of conversations we have at Porn Nail Salon.
I'm talking with Rosemary Romero. Her mobile nail salon and art installation is called Poor Nail Salon, and it's going to be making an appearance at this weekend's NSU Art Museum in Fort Lauderdale. It's a symposium called A Sense of Pride, Visual Activist and New Identities. And by the way, you can see some of the photos of Rosemary's art and find more information about the symposium on our social media, WLRN Sundial. We're going to get a picture, though, of her nails because you've got to see them right now. They are just amazing. And again, just as I said, this is not just a nail salon. But we keep coming back to this, Rosemary. This is, again, art that you've created. The series, again, getting featured at the symposium is called Hyperlust. Tell us about that.
So Hyperlust is a series of collages that I created where I collect vintage erotica.
From where?
From the 70s and 80s of these beautiful women. And I cover them in beautiful swirls of nail polish and rhinestones and glitter and metallics. And it's just a way for me to reclaim that kind of material and make it empowering for me.
What drew you to that, though? Of all the different that you could have found, why that?
There was just an inherent power to those images. It really spoke to me. About claiming your body, claiming pleasure. And I just felt very empowered by those images. They were beautiful. So I wanted to elevate them and transform them into my own.
Where are some of the places that you've popped up this, you know, this installation? Because you, like you said, you've done it in many different areas, but like where are some of the places you've been?
So I've done Wigwood Drag Festival in Miami. And that's usually at Gramps, and that's a three-day festival of drag and queer art. Those are usually my favorite. I do a lot of underground queer rave parties with internet friends, which I love them so much. And I've also done Three Points Music Festival. Every year we do a van where we convert it into a nail salon filled with flowers, butterflies, nail polish, and then I show a feature XXX flick. That's very campy and hilarious while you get your nails done.
All right, help me understand because I'm a little bit I'm a little naive here. You come back to what you said a second ago, underground queer rave parties.
Oh, yes.
Okay, help me understand. I've never been. So.
Oh, you would love them. It's very all-inclusive, fun electronic music parties where we take over a warehouse or a nightclub venue. And it's a all-night extravaganza of dancing and partying, but also about meeting other queer people of color.
Have you thought about going to other places that are very different from the places you've just mentioned to open up your art to other people? Or maybe you already have.
Yeah, I've had sometimes. I've done events where I don't have the typical audience, and they're very surprised at what I'm doing, and it fosters like a different conversation.
Like, what are those conversations like?
Sometimes with an older crowd, more conservative crowd, they ask me a lot of questions about what feminism is, what my statement is about queerness. And I think those moments are very important because it's a learning, it's a teaching moment. And then they get to know about me, my culture, where I come from. And then to have that kind of exchange where they can understand me better so that we're not strangers.
Yeah, and I wonder what you tell them to help them understand so that you bridge that gap and you're not strangers anymore. What do you say to them?
In essence, I want them to understand that we're just all humans trying to get the best out of life, you know?
You know what? Much of the art that you do deals with, again, as you've been saying, expressing this queer identity. Do you think this helps or hinders your nail shop's ability to pop up in different parts of the city, even though you said you've tried, you do it and you try to talk to, you know, other parts of the community as well. Do you ever find that there are places you can't go or it's just a little bit harder or maybe you're worried about doing it?
Oh, no. I always have a great reception. I always have a great time. Everyone is very excited about my pop up. So I don't have that problem.
You're a professor and an art teacher at a number of different places, right?
Yes. So I teach at MIU of Art and Design on Biscayne. I also am going to start teaching at Nova Southeastern University.
A photography class?
Photography class. And I also teach photography at MoCA North Miami.
Okay. For you, how do you approach art as a teacher compared to the actual practitioner?
As a teacher.
Yeah. What is it you want to do? I mean, what are you trying to pass on to other people, teaching them art?
As an artist teacher, I always tell my students to be honest with their art and to make art that encapsulates their values, their politics, and to do good to the community.
Do you bring, for example, like the cosmetology aspect of it into your teaching as well?
Absolutely. I tell my students that they can bring in other areas of focus and study into their work and make hybrid forms just like I do. So I do promote that.
And I wonder too, is, you know, have any of your students been to the nail salon? Have they been to the, to the pop-up salon? Yeah.
It's actually pretty hilarious because a lot of my students don't know me as Porn Nails. So, you know, I'm a very nerdy teacher. And then when I'm out on the weekends, some of my students see me and they're like, oh my God, is that my professor? You're Porn Nails? Oh my God. And that's always wonderful.
So they see you with the purple hair, the wig, and it's a totally different situation.
Absolutely.
For them. Do you ever, I wonder too, this comes back to this bigger picture, the bigger question about, you know, you're an artist, and again, your canvas is this small space, the nail, but as you said, there's more than just fashion to this. There's a social statement. There's an empowerment statement with nails. But I wonder, you know, have other artists talked to you about, you know, what you do? Has anybody ever said that's not art?
Oh, yeah. That happens sometimes. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So some people are like, oh, what kind of art do you make? You know, and I go, well, I'm a performance artist. I do installation art, but I really like to focus on nail art as an art form. And they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah, how come that's not considered art? You know, it's very hard to do nails.
Can they tell you, but can they explain to you why they think it's not art?
Right. So usually they think that if it's like a non-art medium, it's not art. Or if it's not shown in a museum, it's not art. But I disagree. I like doing art with non-traditional materials. I like making art that deals with creating human connection and conversations. And for me, that's the biggest art of all.
What do you want people to take away from this experience? They go to the symposium, they come up to your salon. What do you want them to, how do you want them to approach it?
I want them to approach it with a sense of humor, a sense of wonder, and to just be fearless and to just dive in and get those rhinestone beautiful nails. And it doesn't matter who it is. You can be part of the LGBTQ community or you could be straight. It's for everyone.
I'm wondering about, you know, with your art, is what's the next step for you? Because artists are always trying to evolve and grow and get better at what they do, but also find new ways to express themselves. I'm wondering for you, like, what does that mean for you? What do you envision that you want to be more of as an artist later?
Well, with my projects, I want to explore more about gender and identity and using photography in order to do that. So I want to do a continuation of my photography project called Fluid Faces, and I want to start that series. What I do is I take pictures of people in this really funky photo studio, and I put a little wig cap on them. And then I take their photograph, and then using a digital app, they transform their gender and features to explore their alter ego. And so it's like, I call it digital drag. So I want to continue that project. And going forward, I want to start exploring more about gender identity and fluidity.
That is fascinating. I wonder, like, the typical response you get when people see that, when they experience that. What have you heard?
So I did it one time in Fort Lauderdale as an experiment, and kids, young people, older people did it, and they thought it was hilarious, and they were fascinated by their alter ego. They loved it.
And what's that called again?
Fluid Faces.
Fluid Faces. All right, that's not part of this symposium, but that is an interesting, that's another conversation that we can have at some point. Rosemarie Romero, again, her mobile nail salon and art installation, Porn Nail Salon, will be making an appearance at this weekend's NSU Art Museum in Fort Lauderdale. It's a symposium. It's called A Sense of Pride, Visual Activists, and New Identities. Again, happening this Saturday. You can find out more information. By the way, also check out some of the photos of her work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And if you happen to go, I'm sure that you'll have some interesting stories and juicy gossip to tell her. Rosemary, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And we're going to get those photos of those nails at some point soon here. So, and that's our program for this Thursday, May 16th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.